Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Memory by Fergus Craik and Larry Jacoby, narrated by William Saras. Preface. Just about everyone is interested in memory. Initially, this interest stems from the experience of memory's astonishing strengths and weaknesses. How can it be that the smell of baking bread transports us back 60 years to Grandma's kitchen, while a minute later we can't recall the name of a well-known colleague, which in turn pops back to mind spontaneously 2 hours later? We can remember details of some emotional childhood event with great clarity, yet forget where we left the car keys 20 minutes ago. We remember hearing the news of some shockingly unexpected event, the death of Princess Diana or the destruction of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11, not only hearing the news, but where we were, who was there, and what happened next. Yet studies have shown that such crystal-clear memories are often false. How can that be when we are certain that some detail was part of the experience? What about extraordinary feats of memory? For example, the ability of chess masters to hold 8 or 10 games in mind simultaneously as play progresses, or a musical maestro to conduct a long, complex symphony without the aid of the score. What happens in the brain when older people become pathologically forgetful in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease? And if you start forgetting names and intended grocery purchases when you are 63, is that simply normal aging, or is it a sign of encroaching dementia? Finally, how effective are brain games and dietary supplements at improving memory, attention, and concentration? This book attempts to answer at least some of these intriguing questions. We describe cases of extraordinary memory and the efforts made by researchers to understand them, as well as cases of memory failure due to brain damage, disease, emotional trauma, and other causes. Everyday strengths and weaknesses have been investigated by cognitive psychologists in laboratory studies for more than 100 years, and we look at some of their methods, findings, and implications for real-life remembering. Patients with memory problems have provided another major source of knowledge about how memory is represented and organized. We discuss a few famous cases and what they reveal about the registration, retention, and retrieval of specific events and general knowledge in the brain. The biological basis of memory and learning is a further topic of great interest to researchers. In fact, much of the excitement in current memory research stems from interactions among geneticists, molecular biologists, neurophysiologists, and behavioral psychologists, often working with animals, to gain clues to the nature of memory and its evolutionary history. The introduction of neuroimaging methods, brain scanning, is an important development in this research area. The techniques allow researchers to study the brain changes accompanying the cognitive processes of encoding, the registration of new information, and retrieval. Memory can therefore be portrayed in several different ways. Our own experiences of memory, the rich recollection of a family holiday, or the frustration of failing to recall a name we know well, are probably most important to us. But when scientists study memory, other aspects come into play. Cognitive psychologists document the conditions that affect retention and forgetting. Neuroscientists explore the underpinnings of memory in terms of brain networks, and molecular biologists study how such networks are formed and activated during learning and remembering. These different areas of research are all crucial. A final understanding of what human memory is will require a demonstration of how findings from these various levels of analysis map onto each other, how changes in single neurons combine to form changes in extensive brain networks, and how differences in network organization translate to differences in behavior and to differences in our personal experience. 1. Understanding memory, an evolving story. Some early metaphors. In this first chapter, we review the various ways in which philosophers and scientists over the centuries have attempted to understand what memory is and how it works. Initially, the descriptions were frankly metaphors, but they typically make more important points about the nature of learning and memory. One obvious feature of such metaphors is that they reflect the communication technology of the day, and this is true even of early metaphors. Both Plato and Aristotle likened memory to the wax tablets used by their students to record their lessons. A signet ring pressed into the soft wax left an impression, a term still in use today, and the record remained until it was overwritten by a further mark or the wax melted. These ancient philosophers also suggested that differences in memory ability could be understood in terms of differences in the consistency of the material receiving impressions. If the wax was too soft and runny, it would not retain a sharp image. If it was too hard, as perhaps in elderly people, it would not record the impression. Ingenious though they were, however, these early thinkers were unable to show what corresponded to the wax tablet in real humans. Plato offered another metaphor, illustrating the difference between possessing a specific piece of knowledge, or memory of an event, and being able to bring it to conscious awareness at a given moment. He told his students to imagine they had caught birds of different species and built a large aviary to keep them in. Upon entering the aviary, it might be possible to catch a bird and hold it temporarily in hand, corresponding to a remembered event in the person's mind. On release of the bird, that specific memory is no longer in conscious awareness, although it is still retained in the overall system. This distinction between the many past episodes and pieces of knowledge that we know and those we are currently aware of leads to interesting questions of how these different types of memory are represented in the brain, perhaps some form of neural activity for information in awareness as opposed to alterations of neural structures for our personal storehouse of facts and experiences. Most metaphors of memory over the centuries have described the memory system as a storehouse or palace with many rooms in which memories may be placed. A more up-to-date version of this storehouse metaphor is a large library. In such a system, new books are stored in precise locations, according to such specified characteristics as the general topic, date of publication, and author's name. Armed with such knowledge, a borrower can retrieve the sought-for volume successfully at a later time. Even huge libraries like the Library of Congress and the British Library work effectively on this system. But when we consider human memory, when metaphors meet the brain, as it were, the analogy is less persuasive. There is little evidence, for instance, that our millions of specific memories are each stored in just one specific location in the brain. In contrast, most neuroscientists now believe that memories are represented by neural networks distributed widely throughout the cerebral cortex, the brain's outer layers. Additionally, the library metaphor suggests that memories of events and pieces of knowledge are fixed objects, like books on shelves, whereas a stronger case can be made for memories as dynamic activities of the brain rather than as static entities. And this is the approach endorsed by most current neuroscientists. Chapter 7. Memory, not just one thing. The memory metaphors just described treat memory as being one thing, whereas much recent evidence suggests that there are various types of memory. As an example, in 1917, philosopher Henri Louis Bergson suggested the past survives in two forms, as the adjustment of perceptual and motor mechanisms to a particular set of circumstances and as independent recollections. In the case of a student learning to recite a passage from literature, for instance, Bergson argued that the first reading contributed to the habit necessary to recite the passage by heart in the future, and also laid down a memory record of the unique reading of the passage on a specific occasion. The distinction between learned procedures and remembered episodes is a salient part of modern thinking about memory, and we discuss it further later. The general point that memory exists in a variety of forms and functions also makes sense of clinical observations, that patients can experience losses in one type of memory while retaining normal function in a second type. We explore such cases in the following sections. More than one type of memory. Evidence from amnesic patients. Various types of brain damage can result in memory impairments and provide evidence on the different forms that memory can take. The findings from patients with brain damage can also shed useful light on memory strengths and weaknesses in healthy individuals, as these normal variations between people, in the case of aging, for example, are often seen in amplified form in patients. A dramatic illustration of the difference between conscious recollection and learned behavior expressed unconsciously was supplied by Swiss neurologist Edouard Claparède. Despite daily interactions with a woman who was an amnesic patient, Claparède had to introduce himself every time he encountered her. On each occasion, she claimed to have never met him before. During one of these encounters, Claparède concealed a pin in his hand and jabbed the pin into the patient's palm while shaking hands. On returning some time later, the patient again failed to recognize him, but when he proposed to shake hands, she refused to do so without being able to say why. She later offered, "Sometimes people conceal pins in their hand." This anecdote makes it clear that many things we experience, including learned facts and actions, influence our behavior and thoughts, though we are not consciously aware of them or where we encountered them. A further case of unconscious influences on memory comes from Bruce Whittlesey, a former graduate student at McMaster University. Prior to attending graduate school, Bruce had worked in a hospital housing an amnesic patient whom he frequently met. Bruce saw this as an opportunity to exploit his limited repertoire of jokes. He told the patient one of his jokes and was rewarded by laughter. The following day, he retold his joke, expecting a similar reward. On this occasion, however, the patient did not laugh. When asked whether he had previously heard the joke, the patient said that he had not, but did not laugh because the joke was just dumb instead of being funny. The surprise ending required by a successful joke was ruined by its prior telling, although the patient did not recollect the prior telling. In subsequent chapters, we provide more instances of how an experienced event can affect behavior in healthy adults, even in the absence of recollecting the original experience. The patient known as H.M. In 1953, a patient known by the initials H.M. underwent surgery to treat his epileptic seizures. The surgery involved cutting out a neural structure called the hippocampus, one on each side of the brain. The operation produced no change in personality, general intelligence, or perceptual processing, but had the unexpected effect of producing a severe deficit in the ability to record new memories, while leaving memory preceding the operation largely intact. H.M. forgot daily events nearly as fast as they occurred, as well as the names of people he had just been introduced to. He reported that he often felt as if he had just awakened from a dream. The results of formal testing were reported in 1957 by William Scovell, the neurosurgeon who had performed the operation, and Brenda Milner, a neuropsychologist. Those results, along with later reports, showed normal short-term memory as measured by the ability to hold a small set of numbers in mind, and an inability to form new permanent memories, demonstrated by total forgetting of the numbers after his attention was distracted. Yet H.M. did show preserved memory and learning of other sorts, including the ability to perform new perceptual and motor skills. Among those was skill in a task in which he had to trace between two parallel lines outlining the drawing of a star, while being restricted to seeing his hand and the drawing only in a set of mirrors, so that his movements to the right were seen in the mirror as movements to the left. His skill improved from day to day, but H.M. had no memory of having done the task before. Thus, in line with Bergson's earlier observations, HM had a severe deficit in memory for personal experiences, but kept his ability to learn and retain habitual procedures. The further finding that he could retain information in mind so long as he was not distracted was taken as evidence that his short-term memory was also intact. The role of prior knowledge. In the 1930s, the English psychologist Sir Frederick Bartlett proposed that we gradually build up our knowledge of the world from events we experience, and that these experiences are then clustered in organized mental structures he called schemata. In turn, these schemata, or schemas, are used to help us understand new experiences and form frameworks in which to remember them. One potential downside of this argument is that it is relatively difficult for us to understand and remember information and events that do not fit our current schemata. One of Bartlett's classic demonstrations was to present an unusual North American folktale to an English university student to learn and recall. The student's written recall differed from the original by being shorter and omitting a number of details. This first student's written recall was then given to a second student to learn and recall, with the result that more unusual details dropped out of his reproduction, but other details were added, apparently to make the story more coherent and comprehensible to English ears. This procedure was repeated until a series of 10 students had learned the previous reproduction and produced their own versions. By the end of the series, the reproductions were much shorter, the supernatural details in the original had been lost, and the whole tale was closer to the experience of English university students in the 1930s. This demonstration thus illustrates the constructive nature of remembering and effects of beliefs and attitudes on recollection and understanding. Gossip serves as a commonplace example that is similar to Bartlett's findings, with a story progressively changing as it travels across tellings. To return to metaphors for a moment, human memory is not like a tape recorder. Bartlett's experiment shows that prior knowledge can act as a source of errors in remembering. In contrast, work by George Katona, a Gestalt psychologist, found that reliance on prior knowledge can facilitate subsequent memory performance. For example, suppose you were asked to remember the following sequence of digits: 5, 8, 1, 2, 1, 5, 1, 9, 2, 2, 2, 6. The task would be much easier if the numbers were grouped in the following way: 5, 8, 12, 15, 19, 22, 26. Doing so makes it easier to realize that the numbers form a sequence, increasing alternately by 3 and 4. Having noticed this, you need only remember the first and last numbers in the sequence, allowing the remaining numbers to be generated at test. Work done by Gestalt psychologists revealed the importance of principles of organization for both perception and memory. The importance of associations. One striking aspect of human memory is its associative nature. Events often remind us of similar ones that happened in the past and were adjacent in space and time. In this way, a face, song, smell, or scene can evoke memories of related happenings from our mental knowledge base. These associations typically jump to our conscious awareness automatically, without any effort or intention. Our stored memories are apparently highly interconnected. These everyday observations led philosophers and scientists from the 17th century on to regard the notion of the association of ideas as fundamental to our understanding of the mind. John Locke, David Hume, and John Stuart Mill are some of the well-known names associated with this tradition. The realization that human memory could be studied experimentally emerged gradually in the latter half of the 19th century, especially in the work of the German psychologist Hermann Ebbinghaus. In an attempt to study pure learning in the absence of meaning, he used pronounceable three-letter pseudo-words such as Dax, Bach, and Yat, strung together in randomly ordered lists. The task was to recall the list of syllables in their presented serial order. For Ebbinghaus, successful learning was attributable to the formation of associative links between adjacent syllables, and forgetting was attributable to the loss of such associations. Ebbinghaus was both the experimenter and only participant in his experiments, resulting in the heroic learning of a huge number of lists. To measure learning in a quantitative manner, he recorded the amount of time it took him to learn a list without error, and to measure the retention after an interval of hours or days, he recorded the time to relearn the same list. The difference in learning time between the initial learning and this second learning gave a measure of how much had been retained. If the relearning was much faster than the original learning, it may be concluded that the material was well learned and well retained. If the relearning took as long as on the first occasion, we have to say that nothing was retained. Ebbinghaus found that material was lost rapidly in the first few hours after learning, but flattened out and declined more gradually thereafter. This forgetting curve is actually well fitted by a common mathematical function. The characteristics of learning and memory obey scientific laws. What's the difference between learning and memory in this example? The way these words are typically used by cognitive psychologists and researchers in related fields is that learning refers to the gradual accumulation of knowledge about some aspect of the outside world, whereas memory refers to the ability to consciously recreate some past experience. So we would say that a laboratory rat learns to navigate a maze to get food, but it seems unlikely that it can recollect a particular prior trip or plan a future one consciously before setting out. Similarly, Klapareda's patient learned to avoid shaking hands with her doctor, but was unable to remember the details of the original occasion. Do savings in relearning measure memory? They do in the same sense as HM's ability to improve his performance on a mirror tracing task shows the benefit of practice without being able to report on his earlier experience. The distinction is one between learning and ability to report on particular prior events, different forms or uses of memory. Following the lead of Ebbinghaus, investigations of learning are the ones that were centered on by early investigations of memory in North America. The verbal learning tradition. This tradition of associative learning was pursued and developed, mostly in the United States, until around 1970. Much of the work was done using laboratory rats as subjects, not exactly willing participants, we suspect, but parallel studies were carried out on humans using newly formed associative links between unrelated words as material. The participants were asked to learn lists of word pairs such as donkey wallet, harbor market, soldier orange, and so on, with the first word given again at the time of the memory test, for example, harbor, as the stimulus to evoke the learned response, market. Thus, again, learning was assumed to represent the formation of associative bonds between stimuli and responses, and forgetting represented the breakdown and loss of such bonds. Researchers in this tradition were particularly interested in the deleterious effects of interference on forgetting, where interference was regarded as the formation of a competing associative link. So, in the laboratory experiment with word pairs, when participants were asked to learn a second list with the same first words but a different second word, for example, donkey table, harbor sunshine, and so forth, the second list interfered with the participants' ability to recall the first list, and the first list also interfered with learning the second one. It was proposed that if the interfering material came after learning, it would act back, retroactive interference, on the learned material, and if the interference preceded learning, it would act forward, proactive interference, to make new learning more difficult. A real-life example of proactive interference would be learning French and subsequently trying to learn Spanish. When attempting to come up with the Spanish word for something, the French word may frequently come to mind instead. Similarly, the Spanish learning lessons might interfere retroactively with the ability to retrieve the corresponding French word. Another instance of proactive interference is remembering a friend's new phone number. The old number keeps intruding. The Cognitive Approach to Understanding Memory. Although the associative verbal learning tradition produced many important findings, it was gradually replaced by the cognitive approach that is dominant today. In a praiseworthy effort to put the study of memory and learning on a rigorous scientific footing, researchers in the associative tradition had concentrated exclusively on the observable and measurable characteristics of materials, learning conditions, and participants' responses. The emphasis was entirely on behavior. This had the consequence that ideas of mind and consciousness were ruled out of consideration, along with emotional reactions, subjective strategies, and personally meaningful images. Starting in the 1950s, the cognitive approach stressed the importance of these internal feelings and mental states, and also the significance of organization for memory, the idea that people learn and remember facts and events not by forming associative links between items, but rather by clustering them into meaningful groups, much as Bartlett had suggested 20 years previously. Our existing knowledge provides a meaningful structure that acts as a sort of mental scaffolding to aid both learning and retrieval. The central role of organization in memory was underscored by many researchers working in the cognitive tradition. Experiments showed that when people are given a long list of randomly arranged nouns to learn on several successive learning trials, they gradually impose a personally meaningful, subjective organization on their recalled responses. So, for example, if the words horse, barn, tractor, and chicken are scattered throughout a list, learners might form the category things found on a farm in their mind and group the terms together when they recalled the list later. Such mental groupings can be quite unique to individual learners. For instance, objects encountered on my way to the office today, or things in my living room. At the time of the recall test, the participants first attempt to retrieve the categories they have formed, and then the words nested under each category heading. Whereas workers in the verbal learning tradition had ignored memory for events, focusing largely on optimal conditions for effective learning, memory for particular episodes became the focus for much research in the cognitive tradition. In this vein, research on eyewitness testimony is described in Chapter 5. Short and long-term memory. Cognitive psychologists have proposed a number of ways to dissect human memory into different forms, reflecting different functions and their failures. One obvious distinction is between information currently held in mind and information that we know, but that must be retrieved from a large store of personal experiences and general knowledge. The first type is commonly referred to as short-term memory, and the second type as long-term memory, although these terms have been used rather differently by different professionals and by the general public. The way we will use them is to define short-term memory simply as the function that enables us to hold a small amount of information in conscious awareness at a given time. All other information is in long-term memory by this view. We will go over the evidence for this distinction in further chapters, but just to emphasize the point, short-term memory is the system we use to hold an idea, telephone number, name, image, or musical phrase in mind in order to respond appropriately to a question or carry out an appropriate action. The features that differentiate short-term from long-term memory are its limited capacity, vulnerability to forgetting, and the way in which information is stored. As an example of this last aspect, verbal material is typically held in short-term memory in the form of inner speech, whereas the meaning of words, phrases, sentences, and stories is more salient in long-term memory. We know from our experience that short-term memory is limited. A 7-digit local telephone number is about most people's limit. On the other hand, no one has ever demonstrated a capacity limitation on material stored in our long-term memory. At first, that statement seems hard to believe. The brain is just a physical organ after all. Surely there must be a limit to what it can retain. One way to think of it is in terms of the possible combinations among neural elements. The English language involves only 26 letters, but but we use them in many different combinations to form somewhere around 50,000 different words, or a lot more if we include acronyms and imported non-English language words. The point is that with an estimated 86 billion neurons in the brain, the number of combinations to represent words...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?